Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, July 1st, 2016. The deputy head of the Information Commission resigns, citing lack of funding.
The commission has not done much apart from drafting the concept note on the program that it intends to do based on the mandate stipulated in the act. And we couldn't go farther than that because I personally did not have a space where I could sit. I would either sit in the hotel.
And business owners in Kajokeji are praising local loan project.
I sold my agricultural produce, which I got from my field, and that was through SACCO that I got that money. And then I embarked into business, and I was able to clear, you know, medical bills. I was able to send my children to school.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The Deputy Commissioner of the South Sudan Information Commission, Moses Wol Deng Attack, has tendered its resignation to President Salva Kiir. The Information Commission is a body charged with the responsibility of giving access to the public on information from various government and private institutions. Wol says he has resigned because of what he calls lack of political will from authorities in South Sudan to support the Information Commission. He says the commission's independence has also been compromised because it has an office space within the Ministry of Information. Wol says he cannot continue to work without getting the necessary support to allow the commission to help South Sudanese get information they desire from government institutions.
My work, or the work of the commission then, is to look into and examine the basis of which information was denied, and if it is within the public interest. And the Act categorically states the public interest overrides all others, then the commission would direct that particular institution to release the information. That was the work of the commission. But we are not doing it. Sitting in public information center, which is under the Ministry of Information, makes it even harder for the people to trust the commission and come and ask for information. It isn't right.
In your resignation letter, you also mention there is no political will from the government to fund this commission. Could you explain a little more?
Yes. With the lack of political will, I intend to mean that despite if what the commission have made to see to it that the commission is established and facilitated to be independent, no response has been made. But I still feel it's just on the lack of willingness to let the commission kick off and start its work.
During the 9 months that you have been in the office, what tangible work has the commission done?
Well, commission has not done much apart from drafting the concept note on the program that it intends to do based on the mandate stipulated in the Act. And we couldn't go farther than that because I personally did not have a space where I could sit. I would either sit in the hotel, draft a concept, connect the power, you know, Uber as issue, as a challenge in electricity supply. And the only place you could get it is a hotel, and that's where I used to go. Draft and share what I have with the chairperson who has like a small space, very small place, where I could not accommodate what about. And lack of space contributed much of having nothing to do.
Did you receive any funding from the government for your operation during the 9 months you were in the office?
Nothing I remember of. None of the staff that support my office, till now, we have not been able to support them in any way.
But the last time I checked with the commission, I was told that the Minister of Information gave the commission 5 million South Sudanese pounds for a start.
This is news to me. I've never heard of that. And I would like to be further informed on this. I've never seen it. The only thing I know the government did is to provide a vehicle for the chairperson. And that's all I heard about, and that's what I know of.
And were you being paid during these 9 months? Have you been receiving your salaries?
If I'm not paid supporting the staff, what would you expect of me?
How many staff are there in the commission? Could you talk to us a little bit about the staff who are there, even if they're working in a hotel or in that small office in the Ministry of Information?
We have only four beside us. We have four staff, basically.
and these four staff are all struggling to look for a working space.
Exactly. You share the same with us.
And
we share the same situation.
Yeah, what is the impact of this lack of political will, if you like, using your word, on the future of free speech, free media in South Sudan?
It's actually hampering. It's hampering the work of the commission. It's making it difficult to realize access to information, and also making it even more difficult to operationalize Article 32 of the international security, that, I mean, national constitution, which makes, I mean, it's clear that the citizens should have access to information.
That's Moses Wol Deng Attack, former deputy commissioner of the South Sudan Information Commission. He was speaking to me from Juba earlier today. More than 100 women, youth, farmers, students, and government officials from across Yambio and Zara counties of Budue State are gathered in the state capital to talk about what can be done to calm tension that have been building over the past year between the South Sudan Army and armed vigilante groups. Gift Friday has more for VOA from Yambio.
The two-day peace conference in the former Western Equatorial State was organized by the local group called ADESA, which means Women Together in the local Zande language. Sister Bakita Francis, a Catholic nun in Yambio, heads the ADESA support group. She says, peace is the responsibility of every citizen of the country.
If we want to realize peace in our state, one, we need to forgive. Even the Lord Jesus Christ spoke about forgiveness. Reconciliation cannot come if we don't forgive. Forgiveness is the foundation, and then followed by reconciliation. And then we unite and be one people. Otherwise, we are going to keep ourselves being called by tribe. South Sudan will be tribe rather than South Sudanese.
Sister Francis says it is important for the people of Budue State to speak openly about the tragedies they experienced during the war. Francis says at the end of the conference, participants will form teams referred to as peace ambassadors, comprised of individuals who are ready to go to their communities and promote peaceful coexistence.
My expectation is that at the end of the day, peace conference, we need to come up with a resolution of how we want to bring peace to our state. And then we want to make it, to look back to our ancestors. How did our ancestors solve conflict? And how can we follow their examples? We need to form a team of these ambassadors of peace so that they take the lead. The youth need to take the lead in bringing peace.
Yodita Yepeta is a participant at the conference. She agrees that women of Yambio should take part in such forums after enduring so much suffering during the conflicts in Budue State.
If really this forgiveness that we are talking about, if we forgive one another, really it will be helpful for us, those who are living particularly in Yambio. Because this time we suffer a lot by men conflict. We women, we lose our small ones. We are really tired of raping. We are raping by unknown people. One woman, she can rape by 7 or 5 men. We are really tired because it is all the cause of this conflict.
Baje Wilson represents farmers in the conference. He says he expects the conference to make citizens more aware of the end to embrace peace.
We are appealing to those who are involved in the conflict. As a farmer, I expect peace and freedom of movement in order for me to access my farm and embark again to produce so that I may have enough.
Wanga Emmanuel is the chairperson of the Civil Society Organization Network in the state. He says South Sudanese should remember what happened in Rwanda and realize it is possible to peacefully coexist after civil war.
Some people think violence proves that you are strong. But the violence of South Sudan is proving that we are very weak. We are the weakest all over the planet. Please, our leaders, people of South Sudan, embrace peace, forgiveness. Let us do away with the issue of tribes.
Emmanuel says civil society organizations in the state were affected during the conflicts because of inadequate access to many remote areas across the state. Facilitators from the Rwandan battalion of the UN peacekeepers in Yambio are at the conference to share the stories of what happened to Rwandans during the genocide and how South Sudan must learn from Rwanda. As many as 500,000 up to 1 million Rwandans were killed during the 100-day period between April 7th and mid-July in 1994. Gift Friday for VOA News, Yambio.
From Yambia, we move to Kajokeji, where farmers and small-scale traders in the county say a rural urban financial institution called Saving and Credit Cooperative Society, or SACCO, is helping them expand their businesses by providing loans despite the country's tough economic times. Waki Simon Wudu has more for VOA from Juba.
42-year-old Tombek Chaplin inspects his farm in Kajokeji as he supervises his workers. The workers are planting groundnuts and cassava on this particular day. Chaplin is one of a handful of commercial farmers in Kajokeji who ventured into commercial farming in 2014 by growing cassava and nuts. Back then, Chaplin says he used local tools such as a hand hoe on his small farm. Today, with the loan from SACCO, Chaplin says he has been able to expand his farm.
It has expanded to an extent that I was able to at least, cultivate more than 5 sedans in a year. Yeah, so that's great because formerly I can cultivate less than 2 sedans, but right as I talk, I can just go nearly 10 sedans in a year.
Chaplin says he used the part of the loan to buy modern farming tools and hire a tractor. He says he plans to expand the farm by 4 other fedans soon. Chaplin says the loan has helped his family in other ways too.
By the time my wife was sick early this year, she was operated, and then I was able to clear the medical bill, which was over 5,000, and I sold my agricultural produce, which I got from my field, and that was through SACCO that I got that money. And then I embarked into business, and I was able to clear, medical bills. I was able to send my children to school.
Chaplin says he was also able to build a 4-room house with the SACCO loan. But the farmer says a lack of access to bigger markets for his farm produce in places like the capital, Juba, remain a challenge. He says the poor road network between Kajokeji and Juba makes it difficult for farmers to transport their produce to lucrative markets. Chaplin wants the government to improve the country's road infrastructure. That is Rose Yangi, a 38-year-old restaurant owner, supervising her workers in Wood Town of Kajokeji County. Yangi is another beneficiary of loans from the local cooperative society. Speaking in Kuku, she says she started her restaurant in 2010 and recently acquired the loan that has allowed her to expand the restaurant.
So far, I am now producing local juice because I have bought juice machine. Now also I have bought a fridge that cools water, and I am seeing it is helping my business greatly.
Yang says she took out a loan of 5,000 South Sudanese pounds to boost her business and does not regret the decision. Yangi, a widow, takes care of the needs of all her 3 children as well as 6 other children of her late co-wife. She says she is now earning at least 10,000 South Sudanese pounds profit a month.
The changes I am feeling now are that I am not longer requesting school fees from other people to pay my children. Also now I have realized I have the support from my business for supporting the other basic needs of my children.
The SACCO branch in Kajokeji opened on June 10th. Binya Godfrey is the branch manager in Kajokeji. Godfrey says the branch has nearly 2,000 memberships and was established with the aim of eliminating poverty in the community.
I'm encouraging all South Sudanese that Becoming part of SACCO is really very important. One, it will encourage you to do proper savings. Two, you will also get other services like the loans.
And Godfrey says with such bank loans, residents can develop many projects that will allow them to make good investments and become productive citizens of society. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the South Sudan Council of Ministers amend the country's Mining Act. We will tell you about the changes after this.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what food would you never like to eat again?
Food? Which one would that be, seriously? Oh, God. None. I can't think of any, really.
Eggplant, it disturbed me a lot. I felt if I told I will be given that chance again to eat that food, I will refuse.
I don't like dry fish. The way it is prepared, I don't like it. And I don't know whether it is from my heart. When I eat, I just vomit.
There are some food I've never eaten and I don't want to eat, but there is nothing I've ever eaten and I don't want to eat again. So everything I've ever put in my mouth, I can still take it.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. The South Sudan government says it's working on legislation to speed up institutional reforms as recommended in the peace agreement signed by President Salva Kiir and First Vice President Riek Machar in August. Waki Simon Wudu has the details for VOA from the capital, Juba.
Information Minister Michael Makuei emerged from today's Council of Ministers meeting to say that the cabinet discussed the changes to the 2012 Mining Act. Makuei says Mining Minister Taban Dengai proposed the changes related to the area of land that the Mining Act grants to each mining companies.
It is worth mentioning that the Act provided for an area of 2,500 square kilometers per company. This area, of course, is very vast, and for an exploration company to have that privilege over such a big chunk of land does not allow progress and exploration in time. So he recommended the reduction of that area. In addition to that, he recommended the reduction of other terms of in the mining sector, so that people can really start the process in a better way.
President Salva Kiir signed the Mining Act in December 2012. The act was meant to facilitate reconnaissance, exploration, development and production of minerals in South Sudan to help diversify the country's economy. 98% of South Sudan's revenues have come from oil exports. Makuei says the ministers resolved to amend the Mining Act at today's two-hour meeting.
After lengthy deliberation on the topic, the cabinet resolved that yes, this is a good presentation, and that the amendment of the Mining Act is approved. So the Minister of Justice and the Minister of Mining have been directed to work together for the amendment of the Mining Act, so that the process can start in time, and so that we can also, in due course, generate revenue in this field of mining.
The Mining Act is the first legislation the cabinet has adopted following the formation of the Transitional Government of National Unity in April. The peace deal requires the Transitional Government of National Unity to improve several areas of legislation, including the Mining Act and the Petroleum Revenue Management Act. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
The United Nations reports that hundreds of thousands of displaced people in northeastern Nigeria, the epicenter of Boko Haram insurgents, are suffering from high levels of severe malnutrition. Improved security is enabling aid agencies to finally access the area, which previously was cut off by Islamist insurgents. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Much of Borno State in northeastern Nigeria was off limits to aid agencies after Boko Haram gained control of large swathes of the territory in mid-2014. The Nigerian army and regional forces have now chased the insurgents out of most towns and cities, and Boko Haram controls only 4 of Borno State's 27 local government areas. The spokesman for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Jens Lajerke, says returning aid workers describe scenes of destruction and people living under shocking conditions. He says people are extremely short of food and more than 500,000 people require immediate food assistance.
These are mainly subsistence farmers who live there. If they are displaced from their land, they cannot produce the food that they are supposed to eat. So that is of major concern. The security is not ideal, absolutely not. It's still early days for this opening up of these areas.
Lajerke says the Nigerian government and humanitarian organizations are stepping up aid, but he says the situation in this area is so critical that a much faster and wider response is required. He says the humanitarian operation is severely underfunded.
A couple of days ago, the emergency relief coordinator released some $13 million to that particular response that is a kickstarter, if you like, hoping very much and urging other donors to follow suit.
Lajerke says the emergency injection of money will provide immediate life-saving food, nutrition, and protection assistance to 250,000 people. But he notes a much larger sum of money, $203 million, is urgently needed to assist the many desperate victims that Boko Haram has created. Since the insurgency began in 2009, violence in northeastern Nigeria has displaced some 2.4 million people from their homes. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The United States Department released its annual trafficking in persons report Thursday, and again, Africa continues to be a major source and destination for human trafficking of all kinds, from forced labor to sexual slavery. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Again this year, not one African nation made the report's top tier, which is dominated by developed Western nations like the United Kingdom, the United States, and Australia. The State Department says the ratings are based more on the extent of government action to combat trafficking than on the size of the country's problem. A significant number of African countries remain at the lowest possible ranking. Susan Coppedge, a senior advisor to the U.S. Secretary of State, said the migrant crisis that saw more than 1 million Africans, Iraqis, and Syrians flee to Europe last year has had a negative effect. She said the U.S. is trying to help the destination countries screen for trafficking victims.
So the migrant crisis creates a whole new pool of individuals who are vulnerable and susceptible to trafficking. If they are stateless or without documents or without jobs, without their families, they become vulnerable to the false promises that traffickers can give them for jobs or safety or shelter.
Jacob Christensen, a program manager for Awareness Against Human Trafficking, an anti-trafficking group in Nairobi, says he's especially worried about the effect of ongoing conflict in East and Central Africa.
I think the main changes is the different migration patterns that, you know, we are seeing at the moment from places like Burundi and Somalia and South Sudan.
The report notes that in 2015, 6 African nations improved or introduced anti-trafficking legislation. It also noted that countries that improved, like Burkina Faso, the lone improver in West Africa, stepped up efforts to prosecute and convict traffickers. 10 African countries slid to the State Department's Tier 2 watch list this year. A Tier 3 ranking, the lowest level, can have financial consequences. Countries with that rating may face restrictions on non-humanitarian, non-trade-related assistance from the U.S. The U.S. may also lobby the International Monetary Fund to deny loans to Tier 3 nations. Half of the 27 nations on the Tier 3 list are in Africa, including 2 fresh demotions this year, Djibouti and Sudan. The tiny East African nation of Djibouti saw some 90,000 migrants pass through last year, creating opportunities for traffickers preying on vulnerable people. The report criticized Djibouti for not doing more to protect victims. Sudan, which separated from South Sudan in 2011, saw more trafficking because of movement of people between South Sudan and from heavy flows of African and Syrian refugees through the country. The report also expressed concern over child labor in Sudan. In 2015, law enforcement agencies across Africa reported the discovery of just over 12,000 victims of trafficking. But as anti-trafficking activists often say, such numbers are underreported, sometimes because of poor law enforcement, chaos, or because victims do not want to come forward. Anti-trafficking activist Natalie Ogden says the continent's most developed nation, South Africa, is making strides despite not moving up in the rankings this year. Ogden founded the Red Light Anti-Human Trafficking Initiative, which helps victims of sex trafficking in the South African city of Durban. She says in South Africa, a magnet for migrants from around the continent, the causes of trafficking are complex.
Human trafficking is almost the byproduct of various different other social ills within South Africa that haven't been taken care of.
The report acknowledges that no nation is without problems, including the U.S., and that ending trafficking is a difficult task and one with many complex roots. But the report says it is too important of a problem to ignore. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here is a recap of today's top stories with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. The Deputy Commissioner of the South Sudan Information Commission, Moses Woldeng Atok, has resigned. The Information Commission is supposed to provide access to the public about information on various government and private institutions. Wall says he resigned because of, quote, a lack of political will, end quote, from South Sudan authorities to support the commission. He says the commission's independence has been compromised because it's located in the office of the Ministry of Information. More than 100 women, youth, government officials, and others from across Yambio and Nzara counties of Gbudwe State are gathered in the state capital to talk about what can be done to calm tensions that have been building over the past year between the South Sudan Army and armed vigilantes. The two-day peace conference in the former Western Equatoria state was organized by a local group called Odessa, which means women together in a local language. Sister Bakita Francis, a Catholic nun in Yambio, who heads the Odessa support group, says if South Sudanese want to realize peace, they must first forgive. And finally, the South Sudan government says it's working on legislation to speed up institutional reforms, as recommended in the peace deal signed by President Kiir and Vice President Riek Machar. Information Minister Michael McQuay emerged from today's Council of Ministers meeting to say that the cabinet discussed changes to the 2012 Mining Act. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Damme.
That's our show for this Friday, and we leave you with the song Dawironi by Emmy J., who sings in his native Zande language about the problems of in-laws. I've been listening to Emmy J with the song Dawironi. I am John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening and have a peaceful weekend. Join us on Monday for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.